The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. Well, this week, we're going to hear parts of my interview with Sanho Tree. He's a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and a good friend. Let's get to it. Sanho Tree is the director of the Drug Policy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies and is a longtime, you're a national security expert, a military historian. You've been working on drug policy for a little over 20 years now. Recently, the Office of National Drug Control Policy, you know, the Drug Czar's office, finally released a new national drug control strategy. I mean, I have it here on my screen, and really, it's anybody, if you have 5 minutes, anybody could read the damn thing. There are 20 pages. These things used to have like 150, 200 pages. They actually used to produce statistics and data. That was one of the reasons for ONDCP existing. 20 pages. So have you had a chance to take a look at the 20 pages from the administration?
Well, I figure they're a year late in producing it. I'll take a year to read it. Not that it matters anymore because, yeah, once upon a time, these things did matter. It kind of set doctrine and direction. As with anything in this Trump administration, the policy is whatever the last tweet the president sent out, and he could reverse it on a dime. And so it's driving his bureaucracies crazy to undermine people who are, not to say that they're doing good work, but, you know, a lot of traditionally, when you roll out a big policy, you have all this interagency coordination, you know, everyone weighs in, it takes months, if not years, to coordinate this stuff, and then you have a rollout. With the Trump administration, they do all this work, and then Trump just changes his mind in a tweet. And, you know, a year's work goes up in smoke, and it's completely demoralizing for his bureaucracy that he's in charge of, that he's supposed to be leading. And he wonders why people leak all the time. It's because they're pulling their hair out. There is no policy in this country, except what the king says it is.
Well, one of the things that is a policy is that he wants to build a stupid fence down at the border, wall, fence. It's a fence. You've spoken about this quite a bit. In fact, I had a bit of your webinar on the show not long ago. But could you give folks the quick and dirty version? Why is the wall not going to work?
It's Bronze Age technology, basically, and humans have had, you know, thousands of years to develop countermeasures to walls. Starting in the Middle Ages, they were tunneling underneath the wall to cause it to cave in around castles. There's catapults. There's and then Trump, you know, says he doesn't want a solid wall anymore. It's going to be big, beautiful slats as we have now because the Border Patrol wants to be able to see what's on the other side. And when you have 4-inch slats with 4-inch gaps, traffickers switch to 3.5-inch wide packaging, and you can literally pass it through the wall. So when you think that a dose of fentanyl is a couple of grains of sand's worth of fentanyl, that's a lot of drugs you could pass through that wall over its 2,000-mile length, or however long Trump wants to build it. So there's also underground the tunnels, there's submarines, there's ultralights, there's drones, there's every manner of way to get around this wall. Plus, the most overwhelming way by which drugs come into this country from Mexico is through legal ports of entry, not through these desert areas. And so why would they even bother going out and doing these risky things out in the desert when they already have a good thing going through these checkpoints?
Because, yeah, the fence is just a stupid idea. But I want to talk about it for a minute just because it is a thing.
We're just a couple of days away from the next shutdown. Let's be clear about that. Trump is threatened. He's absolutely serious about doing it again, despite the fact his own party is just pulling their hair out saying, don't do this.
This is true. As we record, we do not have a new budget. There's not a new continuing resolution, and so we're faced with the possibility of a federal shutdown again. Doesn't stop the DEA. Doesn't stop the U.S. attorneys, but it does seem to. But it certainly puts a crimp in a lot of other stuff. Speaking of U.S. attorneys, before we even talk about the person who's about to be the new attorney general, confirmed by the Judiciary Committee without much fuss, unfortunately. Over on the East Coast, up in Philadelphia, there's been an effort to establish supervised consumption sites, these sanitary injection sites, basically overdose prevention sites. There's a lot of different names for them. They've been hoping to do that in Philadelphia and moving closer. There are a lot of cities around the country where they've been making some effort. Some U.S. attorneys have spoken up and said, hey, you can't do this. This is illegal. Recently, the U.S. attorney in Philly, U.S. attorney for Eastern Pennsylvania, actually filed a lawsuit seeking to stop Safe House from becoming a supervised consumption facility and asking for judicial opinion to say that these SCSs, these supervised consumption sites, are federally illegal. Now, back in the Obama administration, we had two different drug czars attend Harm Reduction Coalition conference. One in 2012, one in 2014. Well, one of them, Kerlikowske, only sent a DVD, but still, they spoke up and were present at the Harm Reduction Coalition. Could you speak for a moment about the dramatic change in drug policy that we're actually seeing?
Well, it reflects the change at the top. So we've gone from, you know, a somewhat evidence-driven policy under Obama to a visceral-driven policy under Trump. And it's whatever his gut feeling is, whatever his gut tells him, is popular with his right-wing base. And so he's talked openly about, you know, mass murder, admiring President Duterte's drug war in the Philippines, and say, we got to get tough. We got to, you know, start killing people. And his policies are going to start killing people. So I think, you know, what we have now is a policy of harm maximization, not harm reduction. Not only are they clamping down on opioid prescriptions for people who are already dependent on these opioids, and then thus pushing them into the black market, to the underground market, it is increasing harm and risk to people in life-threatening ways. And it's something that, you know, that's red meat for Fox News and for that gut level analysis, quote unquote analysis. But it's actually extremely dangerous and harmful.
I mentioned the U.S. Attorney's Office. Of course, we now have a new Attorney General, or rather, at the time of this recording, we're going to have a new Attorney General. He's been confirmed by the Judiciary Committee. Now we're just left with a pro forma vote at the Senate. It's a majority Republican, so won't be a surprise. Our next Attorney General will be William Pelham Barr. The 80s are coming back. Any thoughts about our new Attorney General?
Yeah, I mean, it's a real throwback. He literally was the Attorney General for H.W. Bush for less than a year. And he comes from that old school drug war thinking of being tough is the solution. And he doesn't have a problem with mass incarceration. He's been, you know, Mr. Tough Guy. However, he's bound by current realities, which have caught up to him. So he supports, he says, the Cole memo. Set under the Obama administration. So he says he wouldn't go and prosecute marijuana businesses that have complied with that thus far. But that's partly an acknowledgement to the political reality of what's coming up in 2020. So not only are the public opinion polls dramatically different, so 20 years ago it was less than 38% or something in favor of legalization, now it's 66%. So there's a demographic shift in the country, but also a third of the Senate seats are up for re-election in 2020, including seats in Arizona, Colorado, Maine, Alaska, states where Republican senators are going to have to defend their seats where they have legal marijuana. And you have other states that are, you know, where marijuana is polling rather well, that Republicans continue to have to hang on to those seats. And so Democrats need three or four seats to take back control of the Senate. So for people like Cory Gardner in Colorado, this is a very big deal, and he needs security to make sure that the federal government isn't going to invade his state to overturn what the people of Colorado have already decided.
It's going to be interesting. I mean, we're going to hear a lot of, we're going to get lip service, we're going to get a lot of pandering, and we may actually see some legislation too. I mean, it's there. It feels like they're being forced, but this it's safe. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. We're listening to an interview with Sanho Tree. He's a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, a drug policy reformer, as well as a national security expert and military historian. So there's an election in another 2 years. And at last time I checked, there were 9 people who have announced that they are either running or considering running for the Democratic nomination. What should we be asking? If people get a chance to ask one of these candidates, what should they be asking them?
Well, that's a good question.
Thank you.
Let me think about this.
I try. That's this. But, you know, well, I'm not trying to put you on the spot. It's more a question of, like, I mean, for instance, we talked about harm reduction a minute ago, and the U.S. attorney in Philadelphia who is filing suit to stop the supervised consumption site that they're trying to put up there. How can we get these candidates to make a good positive statement about harm reduction? What kind of how should we be phrasing those sorts of questions?
I think, you know, it's important to put the value on human life, on keeping people alive and healthy, regardless of whether they're using or not using. If you believe that their lives have value, then our end goal should be keeping those people healthy and alive to the point where when they perhaps are ready to give up using, then they're still alive and they haven't contracted some, terminal disease or overdosed already. And to ask these politicians, who does it really help at this point to crack down on prescribers for people who have long-term pain issues and have been using these opioids for a long time, to suddenly get them to force them to taper off or to stop using because you have some moral agenda that you think, you know, you want to make a point at their expense, which pushes them into the illicit markets where they have to play Russian roulette with fentanyl-laced drugs and where, you know, they once had access to a supply of legally prescribed drugs of known purity and dosage, to throw them into the tender arms of the underground markets where you don't know what you're getting, and people really can die very, very quickly that way. How does that help people? And I think politicians need to come up with those kinds of answers. While they're prosecuting in Philadelphia at the federal level, look at Canada. They're going the opposite direction, at least in Vancouver, right? So not only do they have prescription heroin maintenance for, I think, up to 50 patients because of the paperwork involved, they have to cap it. It's too cumbersome. But 50 people are able to get pharmaceutical-grade heroin from imported from Switzerland instead of being forced to go out and hunt on the streets for, who knows what to inject. And other patients who can't get into that program are now being able to receive prescription hydromorphone or Dilaudid. For a lot of injection drug users who've used heroin for a long time, they find that it produces very much the same similar effect. And so it's been shown to be very effective. And so here the state is allowing people to get, you know, pharmaceutical grade drugs of known dosage and purity, so that they can at least stay alive during these very dangerous times.
Indeed, and as far as the supervised consumption sites, those have been springing up in overdose prevention sites, which are, you know, have basically a little more bare bones. Those have been springing up all across the nation of Canada. It's but you're right, as far as the heroin and injectable hydromorphone, that was very good. Glad you caught that one. There was an excellent, the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine recently held an excellent 2-day public workshop on opioids and opioid prescribing and harm reduction treatment. And I've played some of the audio from that on the show. It's it has just been. I mean, there's a lot of great stuff out there. There's a lot of great information. It scares me that it won't go anywhere. You know, I mean, we've got the drug strategy comes out. It's 20 pages. the Bureau of Justice Statistics is, you know, it's later and later. Their reports come out later and later. They don't have as much information. They've stopped the criminal. They do the survey, the National Criminal Victimization Surveys. This year, they put in once again some information about the offender and the race of the offender, as well as race of the victim. They took that out for several years, which was interesting because when you looked at the data, you saw that in terms of sheer numbers, white men committed more crimes, more violent crimes, than any other population group. We're not. I mean, it's when you get into the arrests and the prosecutions and the imprisonment, those numbers aren't reflected. But anyway, they finally started putting that back in, which is great. But more and more, the CDC. I haven't seen a hepatitis C surveillance for a year or so. They're a little behind on some of the other surveillance, the HIV/AIDS. On the other hand, they're putting out a lot of information before it's really even final on overdose deaths, on opioid-related deaths and overdose deaths. It worries me. There's this great information coming out, but will it ever see the light of day? I guess we just have to keep trying, right? Sorry, I just went on to a little bit of a rant there.
There is no adult supervision in this government anymore. You think, at the secretarial level, at least, they might take some interest in conflicting stuff coming out or not coming out or being produced or not being produced. That doesn't even matter anymore. I mean, you've got these comic book characters from Rick Perry to Ben Carson in charge of these agencies. It's unthinkably laughable. If someone had predicted this 3 years ago, you would have been laughed out of the room. And that is who's running our government now.
Recently, Joe Biden was in the news expressing regret for his role in creating the drug war, the modern drug war, and all these bad laws. He expressed regret. He did that about a decade ago, too. He expressed regret. Said that they were well-intentioned, but had been misinformed. If only they had known. If only, Sanho, if only they had known. I can't, the words, just, what do you think of his expression of regret?
I think he needs to spend the rest of his days expressing that regret and undoing the horrors that he's caused. He was not just a bystander. He wasn't just going with the flow. He was one of the architects, one of the greatest cheerleaders of the modern war on drugs. And so he has special responsibility. And it's not going to, just saying you have some regrets is not going to cut it, not by a long shot. We have a number of former prosecutors, for instance, running now that also have a lot of explaining to do. That you can't go by this play the old school 90s playbook of being tough on drugs and thinking that's how you keep your nose clean and advance in politics. Well, guess what? Justice has caught up with you now, and you've got some explaining to do. And so for former prosecutors like Klobuchar or Harris, they also have some explaining to do. Just this morning, Kamala Harris was on a radio show. And laughingly said, "Oh yes, of course I smoked a pot, and I support legalization. Times have changed. All this, stuff." Well, she didn't support legalization when it was up on the ballot initiative in California in 2016, and when she ran for re-election in 2014 for attorney general, her opponent came out for legalization, and her reaction to that was to literally laugh and say, "Well, he's entitled to his opinions," and mock him for his position. And now we learn that she's, supposedly been supporting legalization all along, or that she certainly smoked it and enjoyed it. So she's got some more explaining to do. I mean, it's certainly not going to be amusing to the people who are behind bars because of her prosecutions.
You see, and that's just it. We have, it feels like all someone has to do is say something that isn't stupid about marijuana, and suddenly you know, and suddenly they can be forgiven for all kinds of wrongs.
Yeah, and I think also think activists really need to take the DA races very seriously. You know, those prosecutors matter, and they're not all awful. Most of them are. They're mostly not my friends, but there are some very good ones that need to be held up. And we, you know, activists need to know that this is another way to really undo a lot of the harms of the drug war at the local level. So Philadelphia, for instance, not the federal prosecutor who's clapping down on the safe injection sites, but at the state level, Larry Krasner, or at the local level, Larry Krasner has been, you know, a tremendous leader in terms of undoing the drug war. Suffolk County, Massachusetts is another place. And so these races do matter. And all too often, people leave that you know, those names on the ballot, you know, they don't check them either way because they haven't really researched who to vote for. They think it doesn't matter. But if you do get a good prosecutor running for office, it's important to support them.
And of course, folks, I'm speaking with Sanho Trees, the director of the Drug Policy Program at the Institute for Policy Studies. He's a longtime activist and social justice activist, civil libertarian, national security historian, military historian. You have done so much cool stuff.
I can't keep a steady job either way.
More than 20 years doing this thing, so that's not too bad. How much use do you get from your background, this is the national security studies and military history? How much use is that in this drug policy field that you're in?
It's actually tremendously helpful. You know, I've had everything career from in human rights and military diplomatic history, investigative journalism. All these things come together when you're talking about the war on drugs, particularly the international war on drugs. This is one of the most interdisciplinary issues I've ever encountered, and that means understanding how the different pieces fit together. And one of the reasons our government and our politicians and bureaucrats haven't been able to, address and implement effective drug policies is that it cuts across so many different bureaucratic silos that have enormous budgets, and they're only focused on what they're doing. So the drug eradication people only care about wiping out how many hectares can you eradicate. The interdiction people only care about how many kilos can you stop. And so on and so forth. And so very often they're working at cross purposes, and there's no one whose job it is to look at this from 40,000 feet and look down on it and saying, wait a minute, this is insane. But if you look at it from the ground level of all these different bureaucracies, they're doing what's in their interest to secure their budgets and meet their very limited, narrow goals for the next appropriations cycle. And so studying institutions and how bureaucracies work is key to understanding how the drug war works. And if you ever want to stop it, you need to tackle it from that kind of altitude. Right. And you would think the drug czar's office would be, you know, someone to look at this from the 40,000 foot level. But when Joe Biden and others helped create the drug czar's office originally, they put it in the White House. It's the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. So instead of, you know, removing it from politics and giving it some marginal degree of independence to really assess this thing without fear of political repercussions, they put it in the White House. So it becomes one of the most polarized aspects of White House operations. Looking soft on drugs is something every administration has tried to avoid. And so that gets in the way of reasonable and evidence-based policies very often.
There was which agency or which committee would have oversight? Back when the thing was created, there was actually a little bit of a tussle between Biden in Judiciary and Glenn over in Government Affairs. Made more sense to me to have it in Government Affairs because then you would have that whole government kind of, you would be in position to break down silos and to actually take that 40,000 foot view. But instead, Biden, who was the champion of this stupid office and of the stupid drug czar thing, Biden, it made it happen, made it stay in judiciary, which meant that it was going to come from a law enforcement criminal justice perspective. I mean, that's what
exactly.
They do.
You want a big stick or a bigger stick? those are the options. And, you know, when I remember back in 2001 or 2002, I worked with Senator Paul Wellstone's office. This was at the beginning of Plan Colombia. And, you know, every study has shown that it's you get far more bang for the buck if you fund treatment and prevention domestically than if you do try to eradicate drugs at the source. And that was well understood. Study after study had shown that. And so we tried to get some of that money moved from the foreign operations account into Health and Human Services, where it could actually do some good in terms of prevention. And you run into instantly the bureaucratic nightmare. First of all, no subcommittee of Congress or committee wants to reduce their budget ever. And they certainly don't want to give it to a different committee or subcommittee. And so you can reprogram some of that money in foreign operations away from drug eradication, for instance, and into international tuberculosis or HIV prevention. You can do some of that here and there. But to get it into domestic treatment, even though we all know that's where it needs to go, is almost impossible. It's an incredibly heavy lift to work across committees and across bureaucratic silos like that. There's too much money involved, and no one wants to give any of it up.
And that's where the big problem is. Like I say, it's the we need to start forcing law enforcement to just okay, prove it. Why should we think that? Why should we believe that any of these why should we believe that police will help? Why? Sounds that just because it sounds like it should? I mean, that's how do we?
Well, if you look at it from their perspective, again, bureaucratically. They're doing something very clever, all right? It's a win-win for them. So if drug use rates start to go down a little bit, they say, aha, we finally found the right formula. Now let's ramp up our funding. If it goes the other direction and people start using more drugs, they say, oh, no, we have to redouble our effort. Now let's really ramp up our funding. This is how we built this incredibly huge drug war bureaucracy and squandered more than $1 trillion in my lifetime on this problem. President Duque, the new right-wing president of Colombia, has said that he wants to restart the aerial eradication of coca plants, this time possibly using drones. So new and improved with drones this time, which, you know, number one, there are lots of guns in the area after 5 decades of civil war, so it'll be a good opportunity for skeet shooting. But you can't chemically eradicate your way out of this problem. You can't coerce farmers into not being hungry. You can't ignore the fact that they don't have, you know, the basic elements of that we take for granted in terms of ever wanting to produce legal crops or switching over to other types of crops. You can't just make that happen overnight at gunpoint without investing in these communities. And that's what they're not doing. Next week, President Duque is coming to Washington, and the First Lady of the United States is going to meet with the First Lady of Colombia to talk about drugs. I don't know what they're going to accomplish. They're not going to eradicate drugs at the source, but they can eradicate their respective husbands' incredibly backwards policies. That would have much more effect.
That was my interview with Sanho Tree. He's a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he directs their drug policy project. He is also a military historian and national security expert, as well as a longtime drug policy reformer. And for now, that's it. I want to thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network, on the web at drugtruth.net. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.